Humpback whale season is upon us again as thousands of the huge marine mammals make their way from polar waters to Hawaii in one of nature's spectacular annual migrations. Chris Vandercook spoke with Edward Lyman of Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary about what whale watchers can expect this year.
We don't know exactly why, but we believe it's because of the warm, clear, stable waters that are important to the animals, higher survivorship for the calves, better energetics. You know, the calf grows that much faster, kind of puts it out of the realm of some of the predation factors out there. So overall, enough factors that it's an advantage for the mother and, of course, the males to follow suit to migrate 2,000-plus nautical miles to Hawaii, principal breeding ground, calving ground here in the North Pacific. And it just works out. There's an advantage to it, or a number of advantages.
There are other waters that might be equally hospitable, or are there?
There are. Let's say just in the North Pacific here, there are other, when we basically call them stocks or subpopulations, because we sort of gravitate towards where they came from, where they were born. So you have humpback whales that go to Central America and along the Mexican coast there, and then, of course, on the western side of the North Pacific, towards the Philippines and Japan and so on. So in that area as well.
But they choose Hawaii nonetheless. Many
of them do. A majority of them. More than 50% of the humpback whales in the North Pacific will come here to breed, give birth, and nurse their young. So very important habitat here in Hawaii.
Is it the same population that chooses Hawaii year after year?
Generally speaking, yes. I mean, you'll have some animals that will, you know, maybe switch to another breeding calving ground, but that percentage, we believe, is very small. So pretty much the calves learn from mother, follow mother that first year. Pretty much a year later, they're on their own. And at a certain point, usually 4 or 5 years later, they're starting to make the trek down here more consistently down to Hawaii.
Do they do it in large groups or as individuals, or how does it take place?
Yeah, we believe it's not. They're not traveling as a large group on the migration.
Yeah,
but certainly you have mother and calf, you know, groups of that nature, and maybe small groups. There's a lot we don't know in between. In fact, I mean, there's been some whales tagged, but once you get out in the middle of the, you know, these large oceans, the effort, our research effort, is much diminished.
So there's still much to know for you as a scientist. That's got to be kind of exciting, I would think.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, Chris. There's a lot we don't know, for sure.
What would you most like to know?
I know that the sanctuary, and my part with the sanctuary, the Humpback Whale Sanctuary here, is to monitor the health and the impacts out there to the animals. And one place we've taken a lead role is with the entanglement threat. And I would love to be able to figure out more in that regard towards prevention. You know, where did the gear come from? What types of gear is it? How was it set? What parts of the gear? Things like that, because we'd much rather prevent the threat than have to go out there and cut them free after the fact.
Do we even know where they're getting entangled?
We do know a lot, Chris. We do. I mean, so I didn't want to make it sound like we don't have any information. We're gaining it. It's a slow process, very methodical, but we do know it's anything and everything out in the water column. I know people tend to point the finger at the fishermen, and certainly a lot of it is fishing gear, but a lot of it is anything else in the water column, you know, moorings and aquaculture and heck, even scientific gear to put out there to listen to humpback whales sing. We've had them get caught in the hydrophone arrays. So it's anything and everything out there. That's part of the difficulty here, the challenges.
It does. The entanglements you describe sound like mostly near-shore entanglements, though.
And we think so. Humpback whales are more of a near-shore animal, primarily. Mm-hmm. So it's part of it. And part of it is our effort. Where are we at? Whether it's the whale watching or tourist industry out there that might help you, the fishermen, we tend to be closer to shore as well.
You have initiated something called the Hawaiian Islands Large Whale Entanglement Response Network. How does that work?
It's basically a community network that involves multiple agencies. So it's the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. It's NOAA Fisheries. It's the state of Hawaii and the Coast Guard. And I could keep going on. But also the organizations out there, the tourist industry, you know, all those whale watch boats and tour boats, the fishermen, the whale researchers out there, all working together to do everything from finding those animals. And what happens here, Chris, is there are needles in a haystack. I mean, it might be a 45-foot whale, but, hey, it's a big ocean out there.
Yeah.
So finding them, reporting, gaining the information that I mentioned earlier is part of the prevention, getting documentation, and then standing by. This is critical. Along with the documentation, if we're going to respond and cut that whale free and gain the information, we need people to stand by at a safe and legal distance, monitor the animals until we get there, because we usually lose them if there's no one standing by. Again, big needle, a big haystack.
Sounds as if each disentanglement is extremely labor-intensive.
It can be. It can be. Usually it's an entire day's effort. In fact, I know that, you know, I stand by my phones here, wait for that call to come in, and around 1 o'clock we'll pretty much say, well, we're not going to cut the whale free today. And by 4 o'clock, we pretty much, not much we can do. It's going to get dark before we get to the animal. We can tag the whale. We have the ability to put a transmitter package on the entangling gear. That way we can get back out to the animal when the resources and the conditions allow.
But it sounds like, in a way, a bit of a losing battle with resources, conditions, and the sheer numbers of whales that get entangled.
Exactly. It's not the answer. I mean, in many ways, I mean, I'll give you a little history here. When we first started doing this, and I've been doing this for 23 years now or something like that,
mm-hmm.
We used to call it the disentanglement effort. And now we're calling it the entanglement response effort, to denote that it's, you know, cutting whales free is the Band-Aid. We need to figure out what's going on so we can get ahead of the curve, you know, again, back to that prevention. So reducing the threat overall, because we're not going to solve the problem by cutting whales free.
Well, and some of the, it sounds as if there's some question as to where in the ocean they're getting entangled. Perhaps are a great many arriving in Hawaii entangled along the way?
Exactly. We've had a number of cases. I think we're up to 13 or 14 cases now where the whales have dragged gear from Alaska, where we're sure of it. You know, sometimes
mm-hmm.
we're not positive, but at least that many cases where it's, you know, it's been this Alaskan king crab gear or long line or shrimp pot gear, what have you, and they're dragging it like 2,000, 3,000 nautical miles straight line distance to Hawaii. And that's a testament to their strength, and it poses a challenge because it means that the source of the problem is removed in time and space. And for us, it's like the forensics. We've, you know, most of the effort is actually the science behind trying to figure out what's going on. And when you've got a whale that can drag things across oceans and carry it for 6 months or more, it really does challenge us.
What kind of strain does that place on a huge marine mammal?
It's you know, you think, 40-ton whale, 45 feet long, not an issue. It is, because it's a very cumulative impact. I mean, it can be severe. I mean, you could, some of this gear, and it might be kind of seemingly illogical here, but some of the lighter stuff that's still strong enough is smaller in diameter, so it poses immediate risk to the animal because it cuts easily into the animal. Okay, so major physical trauma. And then you have the bigger stuff that can't be broken, but it's big enough that it rides on the whale well, but the animal's carrying it for a longer period of time, and the energetics of dragging that around, not being able to feed, losing the extra energy of carrying the drag along, that, you know, basically the animal will starve to death, and it's a very slow way to go. I mean, it might take 6 months, a year. There's been cases out there, it's been multiple years the whales carrying the gear around before we're able to get it off or the animal succumbs to the threat.
You know, maybe it's because we're warm-blooded, but humans do feel this natural sympathy with whales, and you know, the thought of that kind of suffering really is troubling.
Exactly. You know,
people love to see whales in the ocean. It's one of the great thrills of life in Hawaii, to actually, if you're lucky enough to see a breach or something like that. But at the same time, you want people to be careful when they get anywhere near these huge marine mammals. What's the protocol?
True, yeah, because, you know, like I know the sanctuary, we're promoting it. You know, get out there and experience these animals.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, our presence out there on the water with the animals poses a bit of a risk, or can pose a bit of a risk to the animals.
Yeah.
And to us. I mean, they are, again, 40-ton animals. So the protocols are mainly about giving them space is one big one, and it's the 100-yard rule. We refer to it as that. It's under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely important rule. It's just giving the animals some space and, you know, keeping us a little buffer between us and the animals. And it basically says, you know, we're not allowed to approach within 100 yards and by any means. So this could be the swimmer in the water. It could be someone up on a stand-up board or a kayak to the boater. So across the board, it's right on out to 200 nautical miles. So it's a very important rule. And then from the air, it's 1,000 feet. So any aircraft, and that includes the drones. So it's applicable to the drones as well. They're very common nowadays.
I'm wondering what kind of impact, you know, the growth of drone technology is going to have, because I'm imagining you're going to see more every year.
That's true, and I think different agencies and federal and state agencies are still trying to figure that out. It kind of snuck up on them, I believe. But I will say this, they're also an important tool. I mean, for the purposes of monitoring the health of the animals, the threats that are out there, I know we use them to a certain extent and want to use them more for helping us monitor the animals.
I would think it'd be a pretty rewarding line of work.
It is. You know, it involves so much. I mean, the mission statement of the sanctuary is everything from the outreach and education to the research to the response effort and the stewardship, and I get to do a little bit of it all there. So it's really is rewarding.
Ed Lyman is the Large Whale Entanglement and Sports Coordinator with NOAA's Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. He coordinates response efforts to help large whales in distress, including instances of stranding, net entanglement, and ship strikes. NOAA's Sanctuary Ocean Count Project is getting underway, offering the public a chance to monitor humpback whales from the shores of Oahu, Hawaii, and Kauai. You can learn more about it on our Conversation Facebook page.